Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, we are going to be talking about the fact that children are being taken from their parents as they cross the border into the United States. We're also going to be talking about the ruling on Ohio's voter purging and what that means for elections moving forward. And then also we're going to talk about a repeat offender on the dickwads list. So that is a really bizarre story in a lot of ways, and also very, how do I say this? Illustrative of what's going on inside the Trump administration itself.
Yeah, it's a big show today.
It's a big show today. And I mean, we're not even touching like the foreign policy stuff that's going on, like this North Korea mess, and there's so much going on. And so we chose to focus really on the domestic side of things, because there are some really...
All we need to know about the foreign policy stuff is apparently Justin Trudeau, our closest ally geographically and literally economically, is weak and dishonest, while Kim Jong-un is a great guy.
Right. That's great. So, Varsha, how was your weekend?
It was really good. I went to some museums. I did a lot of writing for school, and it was a pretty good weekend.
That's awesome. Really awesome. I had the pleasure to go to Drexel's wedding on Sunday night. It was amazing. It was beautiful. I cried just all over the place. Drexel and Tim are just beautiful, and it was so hip, and it was at this cool like space in Eagle Rock, which is the cool place to go if you're in LA. So it was just really fun and really beautiful, and it was so great to be there.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I saw some pictures of the wedding that you sent me. It looked beautiful. I'm so glad.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah.
All right, Varsha, so since we have such a big show, we're going to jump right into the news, because I want to make sure we cover as much of this as possible. So the first thing we're going to talk about is children are being taken from their parents at the border. So can you give us a little bit of context here? Like what is going on?
Basically, what's going on is that, Jeff Sessions, we've talked about it before, but on May 15th, Kirstjen Nielsen was in a Senate hearing, and I think Jeff Sessions had this policy a little bit earlier than that. Basically, there's this no zero tolerance policy. He announced it on May 7th that basically, if anybody crosses the border with their children, they will be separated and they will be prosecuted if they're breaking the law. But the real issue is that people who are legally seeking asylum when they're coming to the U.S., you know, showing up at the border, showing up at the port of entry to legally seek asylum, their kids are also being taken away from them. And so it's not just inhumane when you're talking about taking away people's kids who are maybe crossing the border illegally, but it's also inhumane when you're taking away kids from people who are legally seeking asylum, people who are fleeing, war-torn countries, and they're fleeing problems in their countries, and their kids are being taken away without any information when they'll get back. And this is seen as a deterrent, according to John Kelly and Jeff Sessions. This is going to stop people from coming over the border. But the thing is, and this is, I think, what everybody should understand, when you are fleeing a country that's not safe for your children, you don't really care what the policy is in another country. You're not really paying attention to Twitter or to news about, you know, this fake, horrible law that Donald Trump keeps talking about. And so you're going to come anyway. But the thing is, our country should not be separating families. It's inhumane. And the stories that have come out from Senator Jeff Merkley and Representative Pramila Jayapal when they visited these detention centers are horrific.
They are horrific. And on top of the actual act that is going on of separating children from their parents at the border, what's so fucking frustrating is that Kirstjen Nielsen, who is the director of Homeland Security, she said, quote, "We do not have a policy to separate children from their parents." So she said this, and that is in direct conflict with what Jeff Sessions says on May 7th, and again, what the Homeland Security had said again on May 15th. So the absolute gaslighting here and the obfuscating of what's really going on. You mentioned Jeff Merkley, who went to holding facility for these children. What the government is saying they're doing versus what they are doing, I think, is really important. I know a lot of us love Rachel Maddow, and she always says on her show, don't listen to what they say, focus on what they're doing, which I think is a really good just life advice for living through this administration. But I think what's really important is we have to look at what they're saying too, because they are creating, they are using language and rhetoric to create a intentionally confusing and gaslighting sort of atmosphere here. And I think that's really important, because when you make it difficult for people to understand what's going on, you make it difficult for people to push back against it. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And it's basically, I think it's been their strategy all along. And I think it's clear from what Trump has been tweeting that he just is going to continue saying that this is a Democrat law or a Democratic law that makes this the reason why he's separating children from their parents. But that law does not exist. And by continuing to lie, he gets to change people's minds, because that's just all he just has to repeat a lie 50 times before somebody just keeps saying, oh, maybe there's both sides to this. Maybe there was a Democratic policy. Maybe Obama's immigration policy was horrible. But that's not what's going on. What's actually happening is right now, children are being separated from their parents. I think according to reports, in just the first 2 weeks of this new policy, 638 parents who arrived with 658 children had been prosecuted. Administration told Congress. So if you're being prosecuted as a parent, that means your child is being separated from you. So we can assume that at least 600 children have been separated from their parents at this point. And we have no idea what the policy is about, like, contact, about when they're going to get them back. So there's just no information. And with the head of DHS and Jeff Sessions just continuing to lie to the public, or continuing to make it seem as if this is working as a deterrent, is making it harder for us to understand what's actually going on. But we really have to pay attention to this story, because there is a way to push back against it. And we have to make sure that we're paying attention to that. And that way to push back is hopefully this new legislation that Senator Feinstein from California has proposed, which is basically legislation to prevent separation from immigrant children and their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. Hopefully this gains some traction. I think right now it has like 20 or so co-sponsors. And so making sure that we're calling our representatives about this, because this is something that I don't think Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell are going to take the lead on. We're going to have to push back, and push back really hard, to stop this administration from doing this.
What I also think is so important about making sure that we keep families together is that the American Academy of Pediatrics itself has said this is cruel and it will cause lifelong trauma in these children. And I think, again, when we zoom in on this and we look at just the nuts and bolts of what's going on, that's important. We need to dismantle that and push back on it. But we have to think, we're creating trauma for these kids, no matter what happens now, no matter what happens in the next weeks and months as we push to fix this fucking disgusting violation of human rights. We have to think, we are creating trauma for children, for parents, for people who are in our country. And I don't understand why something like that is getting lost in this. Like, since Jeff Sessions made this announcement on May 7th, an organization called KIND, which provides minors with legal counsel, says that this is in the New York Times, said it was, quote, aware of at least six children left behind after their parents were deported, including a two-year-old girl. And so let's say that Jeff Sessions and this Trump administration is using this as a deterrent. So, they're saying, if you cross the border illegally, we're going to take your children and deport you. But then they're also keeping the children in the United States. So now there are undocumented children in the United States, and who don't have parents, and who are now in the care of the government. I mean, I don't understand. They're not even achieving their aim of, I guess, getting rid of undocumented people in this country, obviously.
Yeah, it makes no sense logically. It makes no sense from a human rights or international human rights perspective. It's just it's an atrocious policy. And I'm glad that, you know, our favorite civil liberties union, the ACLU, is suing. So I think just last week, a federal judge in San Diego said that, you know, the Trump administration, you know, what they're doing may be unconstitutional. So he didn't dismiss a lawsuit. The Trump administration tried to dismiss the lawsuit, which said that, you know, separation of families might violate the Constitution's guarantee of due process. And so, you know, the Trump administration tried to get this lawsuit dismissed, and the judge says, no, this lawsuit cannot be dismissed. He did say that, he did dismiss the charge in the ACLU that this might violate asylum laws, but he did say that this could be challenged on constitutional grounds. So there is a way to fight back legally in the courts, but we have no idea what would happen if, you know, this went up to the Supreme Court. So what should be done in the meantime, because this is going to take a long time to go through the courts, is actually support legislation that stops this policy, because there's nothing that can stop the executive branch from doing anything unless you have Congress actually checking it. And so Jeff is just acting as if he is his own, you know, can do whatever the fuck he wants. And we have to do something to stop that, because I actually think that Donald Trump doesn't give a fuck one way or another, whether or not families are being separated, unless he gets to claim that this is like, you know, fighting against MS-13 or whatever other racist shit he's saying. But I think like Jeff Sessions and John Kelly and Kirstjen Nielsen truly believe that this is the best way to ensure that no one is crossing our borders, but they don't care about the consequences. The consequences this has for families, the consequences this has for our standing internationally, the consequences this has for children. I truly think they do not give a crap. And because of there's no convincing them with sad stories, there's the only way to convince them is through legislation that they cannot go back on.
This is so indicative of the way we view people as a country right now. You know, there's been a lot of talk of how the Trump administration has amped up the quote unquote alt-right and the quote unquote white nationalism, AKA fucking racist Nazis. But this really goes to show you that this administration, and as an extension, the people who voted this administration in and the people who aren't doing something to push back on this, we really are dehumanizing people. And again, we've talked about this over and over and over on the show, and I will continue to talk about this. But the only way we as a people, as a country, can justify separating children from their parents is to assume that they are somehow less than human, that they somehow, that it's somehow okay, right? I mean, you can't do this to people unless you don't think that they are deserving of the same, or you don't think that they have the same feelings as you. Do you know what I'm saying? You have to dehumanize people to get to this point.
And the evidence for that is exactly in what the Trump administration argued in front of the judge. Basically, they're saying that these families who are immigrants, because they're immigrants, they have no constitutional right to remain together. And that's just bullshit. You don't have to be a citizen to deserve the rights of the Constitution. You just have to be a human who lives in this country. Your rights cannot be taken away just because you are an immigrant. And so it's horrific. And it's true. And the truth is, like, I guess the truth is in the pudding, in the sense, like, that's what they're saying. They're not even being, you know, coy about it. They are literally saying these people are less than human, which is why we're saying they have no constitutional right to be together. And this is how we're going to treat them. This is how we're going to have total disregard for their families, because their families are not the same as my family. And so, you know, my wife family gets to have the right of being together. My white family gets to know where we all are at each time. But this other family that jumped the border or that came to the border legally seeking asylum does not have the same rights as me. And that's just a disgusting way to think about how we treat people in the United States. And that's not, I mean, obviously this has happened. This is our history, but this is not the history that I thought that we would be supporting in the year 2018.
You hope that if you are going to repeat history, that you at least do it in, you know, I always like to say, like, as a parent, as a person, I want to make my own new and interesting mistakes. I don't want to repeat the mistakes of my parents. And so I feel like this is just us repeating mistakes we've already fucking made before. And I don't understand how people don't see that. And, you know, what's also really, what's really frustrating is that the administration has said that some asylum seekers bring unrelated young children to create sympathy. And that's sort of like saying some women falsely report rape, and that means that we need to make sure that, you know, we need to not take rape claims seriously. By saying yes, that there are some people that do that, but the vast majority of people are not fucking doing that. And even if they were, I don't care. It is more important to take care of these children and to keep families together than to crack down on the very small percentage of people who might be abusing the system in place.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have kids, but I have babysitted my brother and sister since like the age of 11. I would not pretend that they were my children to seek asylum. That is just too much work. That is too
right.
Just like a woman does not make false accusations to advance her career. That is a bullshit way to advance your career. And so this is a bullshit argument to say that, you know, people are bringing other children just to gain asylum in the United States. That is just too much work. That is just too complicated. Because at the very least, if by their logic, if they know that they are separating children at the border, they should know that this is not going to work. And so they should know that it's easier just to come alone. So like their logic just does not make sense, but also it does not account for the fact that maybe 90% of these people are actually families. Their system for deterrence does not account for how do I actually, you know, give due process under international law to asylum seekers? How do I make sure that they are actually getting the help that they need at the very least? How do I actually, you know, vet them properly? This doesn't even talk about vetting them properly. This is just saying, you know, blanketly, because a few of them are bringing children that aren't theirs, we should not be accepting refugees at all. We should not be looking at these people at all as whole units, as actual families. They're just foreign children who do not matter.
And again, it really goes to show the cognitive dissonance that gets held in public consciousness here. Because let's even say, which I feel like this is a very large number, but let's even say that there are up to 10% of people coming in are using, quote unquote, using young children to create sympathy. That's 90% of people coming are not doing that. When we create laws and rules and regulations, there is absolutely no way to account for 100% of any given population. And no single law is going to apply to every single person in every single situation. That's just not how fucking laws work. And so to then say, well, this is really only applicable to 90% of the people. Fuck you. Of course it is. Like that's how laws work, is that you take care of the largest number of people that you possibly can in any given situation. And it just doesn't make any sense to me that we as a country can see this going on and can support this. I mean, the level of dehumanization that you have to get to is reminiscent of what happened in Hitler's Germany in the 30s and 40s. And there's a really great thread on Twitter that I'm going to read. And it is really long, and I really need y'all to stick with me here. But it is by user at Pink Political. She said, quote, "I went to a Jewish day school in the 1980s, which meant that my education was all Holocaust all the time. I was taught to be on the lookout for the signs, the rhetoric of dehumanization and the slow erosion of rights that precede genocide. I've spent the last 2.5 years warning people. I have watched with increasing alarm as the very worst part of people have been liberated to say and do terrible things. I have watched with increasing horror as the worst people have been put in charge. I have felt my anxiety rising as I see so many people turn away in indifference, let alone those who watch with sadistic glee. To all those who told me it was hyperbole, that I was a ridiculous example of Goodwin's law, how do you answer this? The thing is, if it walks like a Nazi and talks like a Nazi and passes laws and policies like a Nazi, then it doesn't fucking matter if it isn't wearing a swastika, and some of them are. Did you think it was only a problem if Adolf Hitler was raised from the dead? Children are being ripped from their parents. Parents who are told their kids are being taken to take a shower before they realize they will never see their kids again. If you don't hear echoes of Auschwitz, then you never learned history or you're in denial. These detention centers are concentration camps. The fact that so many Americans don't care again, echoes 1930s Germany. You tell yourselves, well, these people broke the law. A misdemeanor, by the way. Have you ever gotten a speeding ticket? And this excuse that these people somehow deserve this allows you to ignore the brutality, the cruelty, and the horrific implications. You tell yourselves, these people are less than. Americans are safe. But what is your answer to the American citizens of Puerto Rico? You see, it creeps. The Americans in Puerto Rico can be dismissed. Why? Because they mismanage their finances, because it's so far away, because they're brown. You cannot escape the way we have allowed the dehumanization of human beings. And of course, racism is not new. This is how genocide works. You scapegoat those against whom society is already prejudiced. Immigrants, people of color, Muslims, LGBTQ. And it continues. Women can already feel our rights being curtailed. The poor feel the frayed remains of the safety net being further shredded. Voting rights are being eroded. The old and the sick are being targeted, and hate runs free. Hate crimes against Jews, Muslims, LGBTQ individuals are all up. Vile, hateful, racist, dehumanizing rhetoric spews from elected officials' mouths, and so many have become numb. We are urged not to be distracted by it. We are told to focus on the actions of the administration, not the language. But the truth is that both are vitally important because the casual acceptance of the language of racism allows for the ultimate acceptance of the logic and laws of racism. The horror at the border, the brutality of ICE, is a direct result of our acceptance and normalization of Trump's speech announcing his candidacy while calling Mexicans rapists. Many of us have been saying this. We were laughed at, we were dismissed, and we were right. One of the curricula we used at my day school to discuss the events of the Holocaust was at facing history and ourselves. Because the Nazis were not born amoral monsters. They were people who did monstrous things. We learned the history because it was a process. We are watching a replay as people accept monstrous policies and begin to commit monstrous acts. When we do not call it out, we become complicit. And then, to deal with the cognitive dissonance, we must either repudiate our government or convince ourselves this is okay. So we must face history. We must also face ourselves, because it's not just that we are, quote, doomed to repeat history, but because the history we are repeating dooms other people to suffering, pain, anguish, and ultimately loss of life. In the words of Rabbi Hillel, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, what am I? If not now, when? And so she says, what will you accept? What will you resist? What will you do and when? So I think she really summed up exactly what I was trying to say and what I was so ineloquent in saying. But when we dehumanize people and when we normalize the rhetoric around racism and dehumanization, and when we look the other way at these brutal and violent acts, we are creating the same thing that Nazism in Germany created. And I know it sounds alarmist. I know some people think that sounds cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, but that is exactly what's happening.
And I agree with that in a sense. Like, I'm a history nerd. And so, like, I've been taught you don't make, you know, presentist analogies or really simplistic analogies to what's going on in the past, to what's going on today, because that's, like, not the point of history. The point of history is to understand it, to understand how time progresses, how change over time works, right? But the thing is, what I find interesting about this is, yes, there are clear analogies to this, to fascistic analogies to this. Like, it doesn't have to be. The Gestapo does not have to, like, break down your door and, you know, take away your family for this to be fascism. I think it's clearly already on the way to fascism. But there are also American analogies to this that we have recognized in the past. So Japanese internment, Native American genocide, slavery, all of this are similar, have similar characteristics to what we have been doing for the past, I would say since 1990, whenever the IRA, the first Immigration Act under Bill Clinton was passed, that made it possible for so many of these deportations today. That was actually passed in the 90s. Since then, we have been rationalizing how to treat undocumented immigrants since then. And it's been a culture that we have inculcated, not just on Fox News, but also on mainstream media, in the way that we talk about immigrants, in the way that we make this a both sides debate, in the way that we don't even talk about how human rights works. We have normalized this rhetoric for ourselves in a way that you don't even have to compare this to Nazi Germany to realize what we've been doing to ourselves for so long. It's not just about not understanding how German history works or how history of fascism works. We don't even understand how our own history works. We don't realize that we have rationalized not just slavery, the way that we say, oh, you know, Thomas Jefferson was a man of his time. All these presidents were a man of their time. Everyone was racist back then. That itself is a rationalization. You know, treating people of their past by those standards instead of understanding how we can look at how those standards may have survived until today, that is a rationalization. Looking at internment, Japanese internment, that itself is a rationalization. You know, realizing that it has happened before when you look at Native American genocide and not accepting that, that is a rationalization. Because, you know, anytime that you are thinking about how life is like on a Native American reservation and how, you know, how they're treated by our government, how promises have been unfulfilled, that is a way to rationalize away what we have done in our past. And I think we are doing that again and again with these immigrants at the border. And it's disgusting and it's inhumane, but it's not new. And it's just that we have not been paying attention. And so I totally agree with that thread of Pink Political that, you know, her experience with history of the Holocaust is showing her what she should be paying attention to. And my experience with United States history is also showing me what we should be paying attention to. And, you know, it's true. What is really disheartening is that people have found a way to rationalize this away as people who are suffering, but those people don't matter. They're brown people who do not matter. Therefore, I can rationalize away their suffering. They have broken the law. I can rationalize away their suffering. And so that second that Donald Trump called these people animals, and even though he rationalized away it by saying that was, he was just talking about MS-13, that was a dehumanization point that we should have been paying attention to. And
right. Well, and we were even talking about how, you know, journalists were trying to give him the benefit of the doubt and saying, well, it was ambiguous as to what he said. But the fact is that ambiguity was on purpose. He was lumping people in. He was lumping all immigrants in to this one category and calling them animals and then giving himself cover by saying it was just these particular ones. And I think, again, the language here is so important. And Varsha, I love what you said about American history and how we often look to German history or histories of other countries because I feel like it's an easier, softer way. We don't like to look at our own violent history. We like to look at other people's violent history. We don't want to admit that we've been here before and that we've done this before because that makes us look bad, basically. It makes us feel bad. We don't like that. And so we like to talk about the history of the Holocaust versus the history of Native American genocide or Japanese internment. And by the way, the laws that allowed the internment of American citizens during the Japanese internment period were on the books until the late 70s. And they finally were actually taken off. And the only reason I know that is because it was fought by a professor at UC Davis, my alma mater. And so it was kind of like a legend at UC Davis. But they were on the books until the late 70s. And this language, you know, in the mainstream media, I always wince because I even listening to Rachel Maddow and some of these shows, they call undocumented immigrants illegal immigrants. And they use this language that further dehumanizes them, even as they're trying to speak truth to power and point out what this administration is doing. They're still using this language that's given to us by the people who are trying to dehumanize undocumented immigrants. It's frustrating.
It's really frustrating because, you know, the way that the right, or if you're like on Tucker Carlson's show, I don't know why you would be, but if you're on his show, if you say the word undocumented, he will then target your PC-ness. He will not right. argument in good faith about why it's important not to dehumanize humans. He will just focus on the word. And I think that's another way that we have rationalized our language and rationalized the way that we are treating people by saying, oh, you are just being unnecessarily nice. You are being unnecessarily right. accommodating. And so this, we have really just reinforced the fact that there is an American privilege in what we say and what we do, and nobody can fight us on that. And that is basically the Trump administration in a whole, that we have the privilege to do all these horrible things because we're America. And I was reading about the foreign policy of all things, and it wasn't about immigration, but they apparently asked a senior administration official, like, what is Trump's like doctrine? What is Trump's foreign policy? And he responded, "We're America, bitch." And that's basically what has been happening in every single area of domestic and foreign policy. When you look at the recent Obamacare suit, that they're trying to like literally not defend Obamacare. When you look at immigration, when you look at trade policy, when you look at foreign policy, when you look at the Iran deal, multilateral deals, all of it's just, we have the privilege to do whatever the fuck that we want. And when you do that, when you say that, when you rationalize that idea, you basically say, I don't give a fuck about brown people. I don't give a fuck about brown families. They can be separated. It doesn't matter because we are America. And so that's another way that I think maybe people on the left, maybe liberals, we are also like rationalizing this because we're not seeing the inherent privilege and like in how this administration is discussing their policies. And we're not seeing-
because it hurts. We don't want to admit that we have these biases and that maybe somewhere deep inside we agree, or maybe we don't want to look critically at our own past and say we have some fucking reckoning to do, and we need to start using our own history and stop repeating the mistakes that we've already made because we've already made them.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't think we've quoted Hillary Clinton on here for a long time, but I think it was the second or third debate where she was like, we all have unconscious like biases. And it's something that we are not addressing. And I think it's something that has to be done individually. It has to be done on a community level. It has to be done on a level of national legislation. So, you know, if you guys can all like go up and read Dianne Feinstein's like proposed legislation and call your representatives to support it, because that is the only way we can, you know, fight back on this. Like, confront your own internal biases against immigrants and how you view immigration, and educate yourself on how this policy works, and also find a policy that we can actually change this. We can change this horrific thing. And I think it's all about learning empathy. And I think that is what that thread that you read like really hit for me, is like when people understand history, they're not just like understanding facts in the past, events that have happened, they're understanding how to empathize, they're understanding how to care. And I think that's what's so dangerous about not understanding our own history or understanding American history, is that you literally forget how to care. You forget these things.
Yeah.
And that makes it easier for you to rationalize exactly what is happening today.
Well, it's funny. I was just about to say, you know, I end these episodes, I always say, remember to be kind. And so when, you said like a lot of people will say, or Tucker Carlson will say, we're being unnecessarily nice. And it's like, why is it unnecessary to be nice? Why do we feel that we have, you know, I've talked about it before, but like, how hard do we want to be? Like, how mean do we want to be? Why not take the time to have some empathy and to be kind to other people? It costs nothing. It takes nothing. And I don't understand why there's this demonization of empathy.
Yeah. And it's not just, it doesn't just come from, obviously it comes from like the racism and the support of white supremacy, but it's also just like, and on an everyday basis, there's this demonization of how to actually accept people for who they are. It goes from respecting people who are trans, to respecting people who are immigrants, to respecting people who are speaking a different language than us, to respecting women. It's just, it's all just, slated as something that is impossible for us, that is just too costly for us to respect one another. And I know that sounds very like, you know, hold hands around the fire, but it's just true. I think that we have lost a point where we can just accept civility, and not just civility in this fake campus free speech is important way, like real civility, real
civility,
another person's human rights. And I'm not saying that we had ever reached that point like perfectly,
no,
but I am saying that we did seem to be on a way to progress to that point. We did seem to have a collective understanding that was a good thing. And I think the Trump administration has blown through is that they've just blown through the fact that, oh yeah, we can actually survive without being nice. We can be total assholes and it doesn't fucking matter, except for the people that they hurt.
And just because we've never been there before doesn't mean we can't strive for it going forward. Coco Chanel, Martha Stewart, Julia Child. You know these amazing women and how successful they are, but do you know their real stories? Do you know their failures and how they overcame those obstacles in order to achieve their ultimate success? Do you know their business principles? If you're a fan of Hellbent, then you are going to love the Great Women of Business podcast from Parcast. So they focus on the little known details of these women, and they explain how Debbie Field started her empire at age 20 and the controversy behind Chanel No. 5. They're captivating, well-researched stories, and each episode takes you through the harrowing journeys that led these women to greatness. And it's so important to hear and amplify the stories of women in business, in politics, and to remember that throughout history, while these stories often go untold, there are some incredible women out there that have shaped history. The 12-episode series premieres on June 5th, and you can find episodes on Ruth Handler, who's the co-founder of Mattel and the inventor of the Barbie doll, Brownie Wise, Martha Stewart, and more every Tuesday. So visit Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts and search for Great Women of Business. Again, that's Great Women of Business. Or you can visit parcast.com/business to start listening. That's Parcast, parcast.com/business to start listening June 5th.
Okay, Devin, so what was the recent Supreme Court case about, you know, Ohio and voting rights?
Yeah, so this is another complicated case, and it's Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute. So the basic facts of the case are that basically Ohio was using a process that would identify voters who might have moved or changed their address, and then if they hadn't voted in 3 consecutive elections, they would be removed from the voting rolls. And so basically this was a way for Ohio to maintain up-to-date and accurate voting rolls. That was the argument. But here's the problem. They would send a notification saying, hey, if you haven't voted in a while and, you know, we're going to remove you from the voter rolls. And then they wouldn't actually notify the person that they were removed. And oftentimes, they by the time that they found out, they didn't have time to re-register to vote. So basically, it nullified the right of people to vote.
Yeah, basically, like, they would maybe send a postcard, or they usually are supposed to send a postcard saying, hey, you might be pulled off the voter rolls. Do you still live at this address? And if they didn't respond, because sometimes it's confusing to know what they even want, and I think that's another part of the policy. It's like, it's not a bug. It's like the thing is right. They would make the system just so confusing that people would just fail to respond, or they wouldn't understand what they're supposed to do. And so it just makes it harder to vote. And this is like, that is the core of the issue, is that can you remove people from voter rolls if they haven't voted in 2 years? And obviously people who like to vote, people who like expanding the vote would be like, no, why would you remove people from voter rolls? If they want to re-register under a new address, they will do so. And so that's just the logic of the case, right? But not according to Justice Alito.
Oh God, Justice Alito, yeah. And I are not speaking currently.
Yeah, Justice Alito is like having a love affair with the word solely. And he was like, oh, this law is totally, you know, this law can stay on the books because Ohio does not solely, you know, take people off the vote just because they failed to vote. It also takes people off the vote because maybe they didn't fill in the registration or the change of residence notice, or maybe they didn't fill in their registration correctly. It doesn't have just one reason to take people off the voter rolls. It has multiple reasons. And basically the reason, the argument that the defendants were making is that this law itself violates the National Voter Registration Act, which says that, you know, you can't purge people just because they can't vote. You can't make it harder for people to vote, right? But Alito says, oh, this doesn't violate that act because that's not the only reason they're removing them from the voter rolls. And so they're actually notifying people, they're waiting, and then they're purging, as if this whole process makes it better. It doesn't. It still purges people from the voter rolls who might want to vote. And basically the Court of Appeals, before it went to the Supreme Court, struck it down. But then Alito was like, hell no, I love purging people from voting rolls. Love me some voter suppression.
It's my favorite thing to do.
What happened? And that's basically what Trump tweeted too. Trump was like, great win on the case of voting. Like, woohoo. And I was like, why are you celebrating this? And then I realized he probably didn't read the opinion. He probably has no idea what's going on. He just thinks it's a win when 5 Supreme Court justices side with him. or side with the government,
right.
Which is another real issue here. In the under the Obama administration, they were going to argue on the other side. And then Jeff Sessions was like, yes, love me some voter suppression too. I'm going to switch sides on this.
You know, there's this idea of like use it or lose it, right? So if you don't vote, you know, that is basically grounds for the state government to then say, oh, well, you haven't voted in a while. Like, let's monitor this. And if you fail to vote, I mean, that's just not how your voting rights work. You don't have to vote to be eligible to vote.
Yeah, it is. It's not a privilege, right? And I think that's what this turns into. And basically, you know, we shouldn't just talk about like the letter of what this does. Also, like the results are very clear. You know, Mother Jones had an article that like really laid it out very clearly. You know, this basically violates the National Voter Rights Registration Act. But it also, what it would do is that the result is that voting becomes harder for people of color, particularly poor people of color. And it's really going to just screw them over because they don't have the time to continue checking up on whether or not they're registered to vote. Sometimes it's harder to register to vote in certain states than others. And so this system in Ohio specifically just makes it harder for people of color or poor people to vote and makes it more likely that they will be purged from the voter rolls. And we were talking about history in the previous block. This also has to do with history. You know, purges were really, really aggressive before the Voting Rights Act during Jim Crow years in southern states, and it's still been really aggressive. And there are other barriers as well, like poll taxes. And
I was going to say, this smacks of poll taxes, literacy tests, all of these things that were used, let's say, creatively by white people to make sure that people of color didn't vote.
Yeah, it's just reasons to make it seem as if, oh, they don't deserve the right to vote, but also to make it seem, oh, it's easy if you still want to. But it's not actually easy because the system itself is so complicated that it just makes it harder. And I still don't understand how we live in a nation that wants to make it hard to vote. It makes no sense to me, but that's apparently what conservatives want to do because they want to continue to win elections and can't win it fairly. And so they have to fuck with our voting rights. And that's basically what's happening is like they're saying solely for the reason that you didn't vote, we're going to remove you from the voter rolls to make it harder for you to vote in the next election. So it's not even solving the problem that they think they want to solve, which is getting more people to vote, because they don't want more people to vote.
Right. They literally are saying, if you didn't vote, then fine, don't vote. And we don't want you to vote.
Exactly. And it's incredibly fucked up. But that's what happens. But I think what's good about this case, separate from Masterpiece Cake Shop, is that all four liberal justices were against it. And Mayor wrote this amazing dissent. And basically, I would just want to read like a couple lines from it. She said, Congress enacted the NVRA against the backdrop of substantial efforts by states to disenfranchise low-income and minority voters. In allowing Ohio's program to continue, the court is, quote, sanctioning the very purging that Congress expressly sought to protect against. Basically, she's saying, if you read the letter of the fucking law, this is like, this should not be happening. Ohio is violating this national law. But Alito is saying, no, we can look at what, you know, Ohio is meaning to do, what they meant to do more than what they actually did. And what they meant to do is purge people not just because they didn't vote, but purge people because not only did they not vote, but they also didn't respond to a postcard. They also didn't change their address. And there's multiple reasons why, you know, they're being purged. And so he's just basically putting words in Ohio's mouth to let them purge people from the voter rolls. And
it's interesting that, you know, especially these conservative justices are really selective in how they look at intent in these cases, right? So in this case, Alito is bending over backwards to find intent in what Ohio is doing. Whereas in something like the Masterpiece Cake Shop, you know, they weren't looking at intent at all.
Yeah. They were looking at intent in the commission. They didn't give
in the commission
about, Jack Phillips' intent to discriminate. They literally didn't even address the question. When you talked to Imani and last week, like, you know, they made that point that they didn't even address that question. But in this one, intent is so important because basically another reason for this so-called justified voter purge or this kind of system is that Republicans have constantly made this notion that they are preventing voter fraud. They're fighting against voter fraud. Voter fraud is a fucking lie. Voter fraud does not happen. In-person voter fraud is just not a thing. It doesn't happen. And so John Husted, the Secretary of State of Ohio, he's claiming that this is making it harder for people to commit voter fraud. And this is, you know, making it easier for us to cull our rolls to make sure fraudulent voters are not in the rolls. But that's just not true. And but this is what's so insidious about this case, is that this is not just the first time Ohio itself or Republicans themselves have tried to make the case for voter suppression in opposition to fighting voter fraud. They've done this for over a decade now. Basically, right. Trump's voter commission, the Kobach Commission, is all bullshit too, based on this bullshit notion that 3 million people voted illegally. Totally did not happen, has provided no proof. The commission has had to disband since then because they couldn't provide proof. I think Kobach is like in so much trouble for something else similarly, like lying to the court or something. They've just been lying about voter fraud for so long that they believe it. And it also rests in like this racist policy, because in 2008, Republicans and conservative media like Fox News were really, really afraid of this thing called Acorn, which was a system, which was an organization that would like engage African-American voters and register them to vote. And John McCain himself, you know, amazing maverick himself, said that, you know, Acorn is, quote, now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying the fabric of democracy. Big words from John McCain on something that never happened. Again,
the thing is, and then Acorn was forced to shut down, and it was classified as like a not a terrorist organization, but basically classified as a bad actor, basically, when all they were doing was registering African-Americans to vote. That's all they were doing. And what's also frustrating about the Alito's opinion is that the majority did not actually think through the effects of this policy, right? He was all obsessed with this idea of like solely, and you know, there were lots of different ways and intent was so important, but they didn't actually talk about the effects. And Reuters analyzed Ohio's three largest counties and found that in Democratic leaning neighborhoods, those in Democratic leaning neighborhoods were removed at twice the rate of people in Republican areas, and that neighborhoods that have a high proportion of poor African American residents are hit the hardest, which lay duh, that was the whole point of this. But to see it there in black and white, and for the majority opinion to completely ignore that piece of it is really illuminating, and it really shows what exactly this case was about, because it wasn't just about keeping up to date voter records. Obviously, it was about suppressing the vote and using the highest court in the land to do it.
Yeah, it's so disheartening to see that this notion that voter fraud is this big giant problem has not only, you know, reached the dregs of conservative media, it's now like just common knowledge, and it's gone all the way up to the Supreme Court, that everybody thinks that voter fraud is this huge problem that we have to combat against, even though it isn't. Right. And it doesn't just allow for systems like, you know, purging people from their voter rolls, which is now what Ohio can continue to do and other states are going to continue to do. It also allows for this notion that we have to have really strict voter ID laws and really, really right. strict restrictions on early voting. We just have to make it harder to vote because this myth of voter fraud. And so that's what this case just really represents, is a notch, is like a victory notch for people who want to suppress the vote. And that's why this is just such a bad decision and such bad news for 2018. It's going to make it easier for red states or red districts or Republican administrations to continue to suppress the vote.
Right. And long term, right. It plants the seed that fraudulent voting is some huge problem that we have to grapple with, when in reality, there's no proof that it actually fucking happens pretty much ever. I mean, study after study after study has shown that the number of fraudulent votes cast is so small that it's statistically insignificant. And so for us to completely ignore the academic research on this in favor of this, you know, Trump-Kobach rhetoric mess, I mean, this case opens the door, like you said, to not just Ohio doing this, but now other states can be like, oh, well, if Ohio's doing it and if it was okayed by the Supreme Court, now we can do it.
Yeah.
And it just is going to lead, it's just going to have a domino effect, and it's going to escalate to more and more suppression. And we know that when more people vote, Democrats win.
because our whole system of government is built on checks and balances, you know, when you pass like a, when you pass the NVRA, the Department of Justice is supposed to act as like a check on any kind of voter suppression efforts. But obviously under this administration and under previous Republican administrations, they don't give a fuck about civil rights. They don't give a fuck about voting rights. And so that's what's so frightening about this is that, you know, if you had Eric Holder or Loretta Lynch, you could at least hope that voter suppression efforts would be challenged in court, or they would be paid attention to, or, you know, states be given a good talking to when they're trying to pass these laws. But Jeff Sessions is like, hell yeah, more voter suppression, as much as we
can. Well, and, you know, I kind of have a personal anecdote about this too, because it really goes to show who they're trying to suppress the vote from. Because so after I got married and I changed my name to Handy, I never bothered to update my voter registration, and because I'm lazy and because I honestly just kind of forgot about it. And so up until very, very recently, I was listed on the California voter rolls as Devin Miller. And actually, when I was summoned for jury duty, I was summoned as Devin Miller because I had never bothered to update it. And you know who gave me shit about it or gave me problems about it? Absolutely fucking no one. Everyone was like, oh, yeah, I get it. It happens. No problem. Like, here's your ballot. So obviously, this is not going to affect people evenly, you know, and that if I were a poor Black person living in Ohio, I have a feeling that my neglecting to update my last name on my voter registration would be a big fucking deal and people would be yelling voter fraud. But since I'm not the demographic they're trying to suppress necessarily, it just goes to show how uneven this really is.
Yeah. And it also goes to show how California cares more about encouraging people to vote than other right. states do. I think the number is like now 13 or 14 states have like automatic voter registration when you turn like 18 or early registration when you're 16 or 17. That's the kind of legislation Democrats should be supporting statewide. But also, just so people know about this case, this decision was not decided on constitutional. So this is like a statutory decision. So it can be reversed. If Congress in 2021 with a new Democratic president wants to pass a law that you know reverses this decision and encourages and you know prevents this kind of voter purging from happening in states, they can do that. So this is not like right. other cases that are decided on the constitutionality of the issue of the question.
We are not Republicans. We are not going to sit here and say we have a solution to ACA for 10 fucking years, and then when it comes time to actually do something, we have no fucking clue. Yeah. So let's maybe like actually have a plan
here. Yeah, and I think another problem with this is inherent in our Constitution, or it's inherent in how we understand voting rights, is seen as something like all the amendments in the Constitution about voting are something that say that you can't prevent people from voting because of this. What we need is a positive voting rights amendment that you cannot prevent people from voting for any reason whatsoever, and that they actually should be encouraged to vote. There's no reason that you should be preventing people from voting, and that's like the next amendment that we need. If I was making a wish list of amendments.
I know what Varsha wants for her birthday this year.
Exactly what I want is I want a proper positive voting rights amendment.
All right, Varsha, so that was very angering. I'm very angry now. So let's get into some gratitude checks. So what are you grateful for today?
Okay, well, I am grateful for one main thing, and it's like actually sort of a heavy thing, but basically I read this piece in Jezebel. It was a profile of the reporter, Laura McGann, who exposed New York Times as Glenn Thrush. And I just thought it was a really cathartic piece because it just talks about how difficult it was for Laura to report this piece and how much pushback she got from lawyers from Glenn Thrush's lawyers, from people at New York Times, and how much defense Glenn Thrush got. And I just really liked this piece because it talked about the fact that, you know, or it just really reinforced the notion that women don't make accusations to advance their career. That is a bullshit theory that has never happened. And I'm just grateful for this piece because it was just a positive piece about Laura McGann being a badass reporter, reporting on men being horrible, especially in her own field. And it just dealt with like a lot of issues that you know, people were talking about recently when it came to like the shitty men in media list, and how Me Too should work in the media, and how you should bring about accusations against men, and like how do you like deal with those accusations. But also this piece in Jezebel just did a really good job of talking about how difficult it is to report on this kind of behavior. And I just really liked reading that story. And I remember I remember still being like really pissed that Glenn Thresh still has a job, but that is the world that we live in. And I just thought this was a really good piece to like sort of combat and sort of explain how that kind of reporting works and sort of explain what Laura McGann at Vox like went through reporting this.
And it really speaks to the vulnerability in reporting pieces like this and how difficult it can be and how important it is to recognize that.
Yeah.
So my gratitude check is once again personal and once again very heavy. But as I'm sure many of you have noticed, today is Tuesday, not Monday, and we are recording late. And I'm going to start this off by saying I'm so grateful for Varsha, who is so flexible and wonderful and has just been a shining light in my life recently. But yesterday, I had a very severe panic attack, and I, you know, it's been coming for a while. I could feel it coming, and even though I have been properly medicated for a while, and I see my therapist and my psychiatrist and all of this stuff, I mean, I still have bipolar disorder, and I still go through cycles. And even though it's more manageable now, you still go through. Or I do, at least. I still go through depressive cycles and manic cycles. And I've been in a pretty serious depressive cycle for a while and, you know, had to adjust my medication. And I've been dealing with it a lot, like dealing with that side of my life a lot lately. And, you know, it's been in the news a lot. We've been talking about it with Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. And we had a great discussion on the Facebook group about it. And it was just kind of all squeezed together yesterday. It was so hard. I felt so guilty that I literally couldn't do the episode. I couldn't get myself out of bed. And I was talking to my husband about it, and he was like, would you feel guilty if you had the flu, or you fell down and broke your leg and you couldn't do the show? And I was like, no, probably not. And he was like, so even you who fights for this, who fights against stigma, you know, even you still have your own sort of internal bias, even against yourself. And so I just wanted to say that I'm so grateful for Varsha and this community and people who understand and are so sensitive to the fact that sometimes this is really hard, and that I have the flexibility and the support to be able to take a day and take care of myself.
So, Devin, who's the dickwad this week?
So, this is a repeat offender, and he's also in the running against Betsy DeVos to become my new personal arch nemesis in the movie of my life. So the dickwad this week is Scott fucking Pruitt. What the actual fuck is going on with Scott Pruitt?
He's just, like, taking off scandals as if, like, you know, they're Tic Tacs. He just, like, keeps eating them and just, like, keeps craving them. It's just, it's insane.
It's ridiculous. I, like, do not understand how this guy, I mean, I do understand how this guy sells a job. He works for the Trump administration, and getting fired for corruption in the Trump administration is basically impossible. All of these just scandals are just piling up, and they are weird fucking scandals.
Yeah, it's a lot. So basically it's gone from, like, you know, him spending like a shit ton of money on a phone booth and a lot of like expensive planes to now plane rides to now like spending money on like pens and trying to get his bodyguards to get him lotion. It's just really weird. It's bizarre, but there's a lot of it.
Well, and I think this one is really, this one is kind of funny. It's kind of comical, but it's also really kind of scary. So there's this instance where an EPA employee on Scott Pruitt's behalf was emailing the CEO of Chick-fil-A to set up a meeting. And it turns out that meeting was to get Scott Pruitt's wife a Chick-fil-A franchise.
Oh my gosh.
So he's using government time, government resources, and government employees to get his wife a Chick-fil-A franchise, which apparently they're kind of hard to get. I don't know. But so he was trying to use his position. He wasn't just trying. He was using his position for personal financial gain. And it was so blatant. Like there's like almost no shame about it. And I don't understand how this isn't getting more play. I mean, he was literally throwing his weight around to a private company to get something for himself.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what he said in an interview was just like, he has no guilt. There's like no shame. He's like the perfect Trump cabinet appointee. What he said is, quote, "My wife is an entrepreneur. She loves Chick-fil-A. It's a franchise of faith. It's an exciting time." Literally no apology, no explanation, no excuse. There wasn't even like any attempt to deny this. He was just like, yeah, that's what I did. He doesn't give a fuck, because I think the threshold for him being fired for this has long passed. And so he just doesn't care anymore, because like, yeah, like Tom Price was fired, or Tom Price had to resign for his corruption. But like, I think that was a simpler time. Now he's made it so far that I think he just thinks he can make it to the finish line. But also we should talk about the fact that, you know, this is who the Koch brothers and who like right-wing conservatives really, really want as the head of the EPA. Like, they had no like ideological allegiance to Tom Price. You can find another Tom Price. I think it's just really hard to find another Scott Pruitt who hates the environment this much.
So much. Well, that's what I was just going to say. So I think the reason why Scott Pruitt is more secure in the face of all of these corruption scandals, where, like you said, Tom Price was not, is that he is actually pushing through some truly evil and vile environmental policies. We talked about this a little bit a couple of weeks ago about the CAFE standards and how he's trying to basically take the teeth out of clean air and clean water regulations within the EPA. And now they are looking at further sort of deregulating by, instead of, you know, it's a new tactic, instead of actually repealing the regulations themselves, they are revising how it, quote, this is from Vox, it evaluates costs and benefits in making regulations. So basically, when you have a regulation, you know, there's a certain threshold, a certain cost-benefit analysis in that regulation. And so what they're doing is changing the fundamental formula and the fundamental calculus that the EPA uses to create regulations and to enforce regulations. For example, Pruitt has a new proposal that aims to define the benefits of environmental regulations much more narrowly. Again, this is from Vox. Quote, "Many have complained that previous administration inflated the benefits and understated the cost of its regulations through questionable cost benefit analysis." And this is that Pruitt said that. And so in this example of carbon dioxide, that means that only measuring the benefits of reducing carbon dioxide itself and not associated pollutants like particulates, sulfur oxides, and nitrogen oxides. So basically, you know, looking at these regulations, under Obama, the social cost of carbon was calculated to be $36 per ton of emissions. So that was how much it cost to use one ton of carbon. And under Pruitt, it's now down to $5 per ton. So they've changed the way the EPA actually calculates the long-term effects of pollutants and of things.
And again, just like voting rights, just like immigration, this also disproportionately affects people of color and poor people, because they usually are the ones who live in cities who are closest to these pollution sources. And so basically they are, you know, what Pruitt is doing is not just saying that I don't care about pollution, I don't care about these regulations. It's also just inadvertently or maybe purposefully having a disproportionate effect on Black and brown people who live in cities.
I would say it is very, very intentional. I mean, this, you know, there's this concept in environmental science and in environmental policy called NIMBY, not in my backyard. So where do you put a nuclear waste plant? If you have a whole bunch of really rich white people with access to lobbyists and money, and they're donating to these people, do you think they're going to put the nuclear waste plant anywhere near where those people live? No. You're going to find an area where people with no political agency or no political capital and have no real recourse, and you're going to put it there. So you're going to put it, you know, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago now, but you know, there were studies done that schools in the poorest areas, in areas mostly populated by people of color, are often built near waste facilities, and are by freeways, and are by, you know, these areas that get heavily, heavily polluted. And they're the ones that suffer first and the most from the deregulation, or basically the, you know, even if you don't repeal the regulation, but taking out all the bite of that regulation.
Exactly. I mean, this is just Republican policy 101, I guess, because it's not just happening in the environment. It's also happening with the recent Medicaid work requirements. If you looked at that, how that's going through, there are actually a bunch of like red districts and red states who are applying for waivers to that work requirement. So the people who are going to be granted waivers, or if states are deciding on their own system of work requirements, the districts that are granted waivers are proportionally more white and proportionally more affluent. And so it really is, you know, Democratic districts, but more importantly, districts which with poor people and people of color who are being affected by these work requirements. And the same thing was true of the tax bill. If you looked at who was really, really, really hurt by the tax bill, it was not just, you know, pockets of like red states. It was mainly blue states were just targeted by this.
Right.
And so it's obvious that this is what they're doing. It's like NIMBY is like the basis, I guess, of all of Republican policies. Like, I want to do all of these horrible things to cut costs and make government really, really tiny, but I don't want to live the effects of these horrible things. Like, I want to make sure me as a white person gets to keep my family together, gets to vote whenever they want, gets to, like, you know, be respected, their right to vote to be respected, and gets to live with clean air. But these other people, I don't give a fuck about them. I guess that is Republican 101.
And going back to how, like, NIMBY and how this affects, you know, minorities, people of color, poor people the most. So the EPA is also trying to say that the only harm that counts from a pollutant. So basically something, the only way something could be considered harm from a pollutant is with direct contact with hazardous chemicals. And so a lot of why this affects people of color and poor communities the most is because of the secondhand effects. So soil contamination or air pollution or, you know, asbestos containing tiles or lead paint, that sort of thing. What the EPA is trying to say is that the secondary effects are no longer considered part of the harm of the chemical itself. And so you're getting this stratification. And so you're saying, well, these regulations are now not just blatantly, you know, rolling back environmental protections, but they're actually going after what's actually affecting these communities the most. It's almost always secondary effects. And so for the EPA to basically say we're no longer concerned about secondary effects is so intentionally ignoring the impact that these have on poor communities of color.
It's just so disheartening to see this happen like over and over and over again in different policies and different arenas. It's just like the same pattern. And I think that's sort of what the theme of today's episode has been. It's happened before and it's happening again.
Well, and then House Democrats actually want to launch a criminal investigation into Pruitt and his collection of 100,000 scandals. But Trump said, quote, Scott Pruitt is doing a great job within the walls of the EPA. I mean, we're setting records. Outside, he's being attacked very viciously by the press. And I'm not saying that he's blameless, but we'll see what happens. So basically, yeah, he's willing to trade these scandals for this sort of ruthless dismantling of the EPA itself.
I can't handle one more day of Trump's vamping. It's just like, it's just so obvious that that's what he does when he doesn't know the answer. It's just like, we'll see what happens. He just gives you both sides of the answer, but leans heavily on the fact that the press is mean and shit. The same thing happened when he was talking about North Korea. He was just like vamping yesterday, and it was just like so frustrating, especially when people like Scott Pruitt are committing very real crimes.
All right, Varsha, last but not least, let's talk about some action items. So something our listeners can do after they listen to the show. So what do we have up?
The first thing they can do is that they can call their senators to stop, pass legislation to stop DHS from separating children from their parents at the border. So you can actually go to the ACLU /ACLU.org/issues/call-senators-stop-DHS-separating-children. That website is already online, so you can like look it up online, and you can like sign a petition to make sure that senators know that you don't want children separated at the border. But you can also just call your senators on your own. Dianne Feinstein has legislation. There are at least 20 co-sponsors. So if you live in a red state, because I don't think there are any Republican co-sponsors yet, make sure to call your senator. Make sure to continue to bug them, get five people to bug them. This is like a serious issue. And think of every single issue where we're telling you to call your senators as like the Obamacare issue that we fought so hard for in 2017, where people showed up in droves, or the protests against the Muslim ban. Like, this is just as important. There should be like huge protests at the border, but obviously that is difficult to manage. And so we should be continuing to put pressure on our elected officials to stop this. And that's the first thing you can do, is you can call your senators. And the second thing is that you can donate to an Act Blue fund called Kids at the Border, and you can actually support them. And they're supporting a bunch of different organizations that protect kids who are separated from their families.
Yeah, it's just a centralized place that you can donate. And then they work with these organizations that make sure that the kids at the border have the services and support that they need. I was telling Varsha when we were talking about what to do on the show today, I was like, look, I'm going to put this, the kids being separated from their parents, on every show until something is done. Even if it's a quick, small little update section, we cannot lose sight of this. Like Varsha said, we showed up in droves to save Obamacare, and we fucking did it. We can do this, but we just need to make sure that this is something that is just as important. And I know it's hard. Even if you care, it's hard. It's a very intangible in a lot of ways, especially if you don't live in a border state, especially if you don't know undocumented immigrants. It can be very difficult to conceptualize why this is so important, but we cannot take our eyes off of it. So the ACLU has scripts and things to say to your senators, which is why we included the link to the ACLU. But yes, please call them. Please tell them this is unacceptable. And, you know, let's make sure that these kids are on top of mind at all times.
I'll post both the links on my Twitter and also on the Facebook group so people know where to find it. But it's just so important that we don't lose sight of this issue, because like just like DACA and the Muslim ban, like we sort of forgot about it after a while. Same thing when it came to other horrible things that like the administration is doing. We've sort of like forgotten about it. And it's just important that this, because it's so clear the effect that is having on everyday people, on children, I agree with Devin that we just cannot keep it out of mind. We cannot push it to the back of our mind. We just have to be consistently angry about this, because this is just as important as going to calling your senator about Obamacare. This is even more important.
Yeah. All right. Well, that does it for us. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back here on Thursday with a very special guest. So, Varsha, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, raise some hell and remember to be kind.